97.1 FM Talk Podcast. This hour of the Mark Reardon Show is sponsored by Gamma Tree Experts. Your trees deserve the best care. Call Gamma Tree Experts. This is the Mark Reardon Show on 97.1 FM Talk.
You know, I said this earlier, despite the holiday, I feel like this week is going by terribly slowly, but we'll get to Friday tomorrow. We're going to have a Reardon Roundtable at 3, former state senators John Lamping and Jeff Smith. Something tells me we'll talk about the Missouri congressional map and that chaos and mess, which the very latest, by the way, in case you haven't heard, is Denny Hoskins, the Secretary of State, has agreed to use the 22 maps. So the old maps in November, not the new maps. There is still some work to be done before the 8th Circuit for a request for a preliminary injunction, but that's not going to happen at the earliest until next week. So it is kind of a mess. Got a lot of national attention, but it looks like voters who voted early August will be disenfranchised and not have the same congressional maps, which is utterly confusing to me. We'll get into it tomorrow. Paul Hall with some movie and streaming recommendations. I can't wait for Brothers, which I think starts next week on Apple TV Plus with Matthew McConaughey and Woody Harrelson essentially playing fictionalized versions of themselves, but that looks pretty entertaining. So we'll get into that. We'll have Cusimano here, of course, the big Mizzou game with KU tomorrow night. We can talk about that with our next guest, too. The assistant director of the FBI might not be the top of his mind because there's a lot of things going on, but Andrew Bailey's here, and he's a big Mizzou fan. How are you, M-I-Z, Andrew? Good to have you on.
Z-O-U, my friend. I'm expecting big things out of Lawrence tomorrow. Hopefully Mizzou can. Yeah, I think I read a statistic. We've only won in Lawrence like three times since 1980. That's crazy. Let's make it four.
I have to tell you, I'm nervous because the line in this game is only like 5.5, and I feel like we should win this thing by like 2 or 3 touchdowns. So I hope that they exceed expectations tomorrow. And I liked what I saw from Austin Simmons last week, so we'll keep our fingers crossed. But you're going to be in Manhattan for 9/11 ceremonies tomorrow, won't you, Andrew?
Yes, sir. I'm in New York now, prepared to honor the memory of those who have fallen and those who served. Look, this was a devastating attack, the worst terror attack against the United States in our nation's history, and it forever changed certainly the trajectory of my life, causing me to go into the Army in a combat arms role and deploy to Iraq twice, changed the lives of so many other Americans, and certainly it changed the history of the FBI. But we want to be here to honor those that have fallen and those that continue to serve.
Yeah, well, let's circle back to what happened in your situation, because I think some people, you know, despite the fact that you were here as Attorney General for a short time, might not know your background and your story and kind of how you got to the point where you are. But it was 9/11 that sort of inspired you in that moment to go into the military?
Yeah, look, I was going to Mizzou on an Army ROTC scholarship in 1999, planned on being an Army attorney. I remember sitting at my residence and watching the planes hit the buildings and understanding that my life would forever change. Volunteered for a combat arms branch of service in the Army, so didn't go to law school at first, went into the Army as an armor officer trained on tanks, and then ended up in the last heavy armored cavalry regiment as a platoon leader, later a company commander in two different deployments to Iraq. But proud to have served, and certainly, like I said, want to honor those who continue to serve to this day.
You know, I said this earlier in the show, and I've said this yesterday. I don't know why it is, but for whatever reason, this 25th anniversary of 9/11 is hitting me harder than the previous anniversaries. I'm spending a lot of time this week listening to some of the audio, watching some of the video. I've seen some of these, you know, documentaries. By the way, there is what I think might be a really good documentary on the MLB Network tonight, which focuses on baseball and baseball's, you know, role in recovering from 9/11. I was in Milwaukee, by the way, the Cardinals. I was supposed to go to the game that night. The Cardinals were supposed to play the Brewers on that Tuesday night, but the MLB Network will have that tonight. But I don't know why it is, and maybe it's part of it because I want people who are not alive or people who might not have remembered as much of this to be remembered or to have a memory of how horrific this was for this country and for the world on that day. I mean, when you watch these videos and you're reminded of not only the planes going into the towers, Andrew, but, you know, when the towers collapse, you know, there's people watching, just hanging out in Manhattan, looking up at the explosions, being amazed that something happened, and then all of a sudden these two ginormous buildings just crater and fall to the ground.
Yeah, I mean, just again, a devastating terror attack that killed more than 2,700 innocent victims. And you think about the firefighters, the police, FBI special agents and professional staff who raced down to ground zero to the buildings as they were collapsing in order to begin recovery operations, response operations, and just the toll it has taken on the victims and their families and the survivors. I mean, just an enormous matter. I watched in shock and horror as it happened, and I watch in shock and horror today as it seems like too often people in leadership positions have forgotten or neglect to speak with moral clarity as it relates to the evils of the jihadist terrorists who attacked us in an unprovoked, devastating attack on 9/11 and the innocent victims who lost their lives. But the heroism that was on display by the men and women, first responders, is really remarkable.
And the heroism of those people on Flight 93. And I'm going to focus on that with some audio here. My mother used to work for Airphone, Andrew, and she would go on planes. It was kind of a fun gig, and she'd teach people how to use these phones. Her boss in suburban Chicago was a woman by the name of Lisa Jefferson. Lisa Jefferson is the woman who took the call from Todd Beamer and was on, you know, the phone with him for like 20 minutes. And poor Lisa Jefferson, you know, you talk about the families and the people who were connected to this. She had so much stress and PTSD in the aftermath of this, she had to quit her job at Airphone. So there were so many different people who were affected throughout the entire country that had, you know, whether there were relatives or family members or friends that were in New York or on one of these planes. I mean, I never want to forget the Pentagon. You know, we don't seem to talk about that. You probably know this because you're in D.C. I was there for the opening of the 9/11 memorial at the Pentagon, and that's quite a sight. And the 9/11 memorial in New York City is something that everyone should see because they did a great job with it.
Yeah, totally agree. Look, the coordinated attack, right? And it took a lot of preparation. And look, prior to that incident, prior to 9/11/2001, the FBI treated terrorist attacks as crime scenes to be investigated after the fact. What changed after 9/11, after more than 4,000 special agents and 3,000 professional staff participated in this investigation after 9/11, the largest investigation in FBI history, we changed our strategies. Now we're forward-leaning, proactive. Instead of just waiting until something happens and then investigating as a criminal matter, we now work to investigate, dismantle, and disrupt before the attacks happen. And the numbers that we put together over the past year have been remarkable. More than 700 different arrests and terror cells disrupted. So these are truly remarkable numbers. And it really goes back to refocusing on the core mission of the FBI. And when we do that, we can deliver real results, and it makes Americans more safe, and it makes Missourians more safe.
You know, I think one of the things that a lot of people were confused by and didn't understand at the time, and I'm thinking that this has really grown a lot, is that there was not as much, and we find this even in some of the serial cases, you know, the killer cases from the 70s or the 80s, certainly in the 80s and 90s, that there was not as much communication with the FBI, with local law enforcement in different agencies, and that was something that certainly got corrected in the aftermath of 9/11, wasn't it?
Oh, completely. Look, we had joint terrorism task forces stood up across the nation, but those doubled, quadrupled in size in short order. And I'm proud to say that just in my time at the FBI, we've actually eliminated administrative burdens that allow local law enforcement to participate on those joint terrorism task forces. Last year alone, we added 2,770 more local state officers on our JTTFs because we're eliminating the red tape. That's more communication. And what it's about is getting the intelligence from the top down to the people that actually use it to make the arrests, the disruptions, the dismantlement of those terror cells.
So what do you have anything that you're doing right now in your role that is specific to that, or are you doing a bunch of different things at the same time?
You know, just trying to cover all the bases.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, and that's what's unique about the Bureau, right? I mean, we've got the Criminal Justice Information Services where we put together the Uniform Crime Report that was just published that shows the, you know, most remarkable reduction in violent crime in this nation's history, certainly within the last century. We manage laboratory and forensic analysis, evidence recovery and response, special event coordination with the FIFA security. But then we've got our standard criminal investigations. We've got our national security investigations and operations. We're a component of the intelligence community. So you roll that all into this massive operation, 38,000 employees, 56 field offices, more than 60 law enforcement attachés overseas. It is a large, dynamic, complex organization of which I'm proud to serve. And again, with the mandate coming from the very top, from the White House, from President Trump after his historic election win, to make America safe again and refocus on that core mission of protecting the American people and upholding the Constitution.
Andrew Bailey is here. He's the former Attorney General of Missouri, current Assistant Director of the FBI. Will you have an official role tomorrow in the 9/11 ceremonies?
You just there to observe, honor, and remember, and be a participant. I don't have a speaking role, but certainly want my presence to demonstrate that we honor all of those who fell, and certainly the 34 different employees of the FBI who are now on our wall of honor, whose deaths are directly attributable to those events of 9/11.
Amazing. All right. Well, listen, you can't say enjoy the moment tomorrow, but I know it's going to be very special and the country is going to be watching as well. It'll be very interesting to see if Mayor Mamdani becomes a focal point, because there's some people that are encouraging him not to be there. But Andrew, it's great to hear from you. I hope that you can have a great ceremony tomorrow and that we can both be, you know, relaxing tomorrow night about 10 o'clock celebrating a Mizzou win over KU. Let's hope for that, right?
Hey, God bless you, my friend. M-I-Z.
Z-O-U. Take care, Andrew Bailey. I mentioned Lisa Jefferson. I want to, you know, in the next couple of days, I did this yesterday and certainly Tuesday, I want to sprinkle in some things, because some of this you've heard before over the years, some of it you need to hear again. But Lisa Jefferson was the airphone worker. I told you, she was my mother's boss, actually. And Todd Beamer made this call, and, you know, this became legendary because of what happened on Flight 93 with those heroic passengers. And, you know, Sue, one of the things that I've noticed, and I don't know how much time I'm going to have here to play some of this audio, but there were so many people that made phone calls to their family members, and they sounded more calm than I think anyone could ever calm. Maybe it was because they mentally wanted to tell themselves, don't panic their loved ones, even though they knew they were going to die in all likelihood, right? But it's been remarkable just to hear the tone in a lot of the voices. Now, you know, you got people out there. This is what drives me nuts. I ran across a Twitter account today of someone who was trying to make the case that these phone calls were all fake, that there was not the ability to make a cell phone call in 2001. There was, of course. In fact, it was easier at that time because there wasn't as much competition.
Right.
So you could do it, and these planes were flying at a lower altitude. Okay, so by the way, for people who might think that, what do you think really happened there? You found 3,000 people, or just look at the people on Flight 93. They were all involved in this, and they all agreed to be killed because it was some sort of conspiracy, and we brought this on them. So it's just incredible that this stuff spreads on, you know, social media, and that people actually buy into it.
Yes.
It's crazy. But here's the phone call that Lisa Jefferson had with Todd Beamer, and her talking about some of this.
When I took the call over, there was a soft-spoken, calm gentleman on the other end. He told me that there's three people that have taken over the flight. At that point, I asked him his name. He told me Todd Beamer. He was from Cranberry, New Jersey.
Did you make a conscious decision not to tell Todd about the World Trade Center? Why?
Yes. Because I wanted him to have hope. I wanted him to think that he still had a chance. I didn't want him to feel like it was just totally hopeless, and he definitely didn't have a choice, and he knew he was going to die. I didn't want him to have that feeling.
When he wanted to pray, was your sense then that he knew that?
Yes, I did. I felt that he knew at that time, because he had said, oh, Jesus, help us. And then he said, Lisa, would you recite the Lord's Prayer with me? And I knew that he knew at that time that it wasn't much left for him to do.
What do you think that this country needs to know about the men and women who were on board Flight 93?
They're all heroes in my eyes. They really are. They all pitched together, and they did what they thought was the best thing to do at that time. And I feel that Todd played a great role in that, because when he told the guys, are you ready? I assumed that they were waiting on his cue. Then they responded to him, and he said, okay, let's roll.
And would you please help me welcome his wife, Lisa Beamer, here tonight?
She called me that Saturday morning. I told her, I said, you have two boys, David and Andrew? She said, yes, I do. I said, you're expecting your third child? She said, yes, he told you all of that. I said, yes, he did. And he wanted me to let you know that he loved you and his family very much. And I gave her a message and kept my promise.
You know, I texted my mother today, and I was asking her to remind me, because, again, Lisa was her boss at Airphone.
Oh,
and that was
a
phone call, by the way, that took place with an Airphone. It wasn't with a cell phone, right?
Right.
And it was relatively new technology. But my mother reminded me that Lisa had really, really tough time dealing with this and had to, quit and retire. Of course. So this is
great,
Edward
Felt. By the way.
Oh, amazing,
I
right?
mean,
so this is from that flight. This is Edward Felt, who's making a call from Flight 93.
Hijacking in progress. Excuse me? Hey, something is reported.
Hijacking in progress.
Sir, I'm losing you. Where are you at?
United Flight 93.
Wait a minute.
United
Flight 93.
Hijacking in progress.
Okay, where are you out of?
I'm in the bathroom. United Flight
93. Okay, where are you at?
So, you know, the guy is, they're both frustrated. Edward's trying to tell him what's happening on the flight. But again, Flight 93, okay, like, where are you? Yeah. Where is the actual plane, right?
How's he going to
know? Where the plane
well,
is.
Right.
Where did you take off at?
Newark to San Francisco.
Newark to San Francisco.
Okay.
United
I get it. Okay, stay on the phone with me, sir.
I'm trying to, sir. At the bathroom.
Okay.
What's going on. Hey, somebody get the FAA. Newark to San Francisco. I got a hijacking in progress.
Okay.
There. Yeah. Get somebody from the airport on the line. This is a hijacking in progress.
Are you still there, sir?
Yes, I am.
What's your name, sir?
Edward Felt.
Edward Felt. What's your phone number, sir?
732.
Go ahead.
241.
Go ahead.
6974.
How big of a plane, sir?
That's a 757.
This is a 757.
I mean, this is crazy that they're communicating this all at the same time, right?
Sir?
Yes.
Okay, how many people's on the plane?
It was pretty empty.
And from there, there's not a lot of communication, and at a certain point, it kind of goes dead. Which, you know, that's when they tried to take over from the hijackers, and they landed, you know, in the field. They crashed in Shanksville. Here's Linda Gronlund, who also had some words from that Flight 93.
Alpha, Flynn, I only have a minute. I'm on United 93, and it's been hijacked by terrorists who say they have a bomb. Apparently, they have flown a couple of planes into the World Trade Center already, and it looks like they're going to take this one down as well. Mostly, I just wanted to say I love you, and I'm going to miss you, and please give my love to my dad, and mostly, I just love you, and I just wanted to tell you that. I don't know if I'm going to be able to tell you that again or not. All my stuff is in a safe. The safe is in my closet in my bedroom.
She gives the combination out here.
Keeper clear, and then 0913, and then it should, and maybe pound, and then it should unlock. I love you, and I hope I can talk to you soon. Bye.
I mean, I don't even know how you put that into words. And then, you know, some of the other calls that were happening at the same time from the top of the World Trade Center towers. And there were people who knew that the planes had crashed and that there were explosions and that the building was on fire. And they knew that they couldn't get down to the ground. There was no way. The only way they could have been rescued is from the air. And that was, you know, a long shot. So the amount, and Linda in particular there, I mean, she tried to, again, maybe some of these people made these calls knowing that they didn't want to scare the crap out of their family members and they didn't want to leave them with the memories of them crying and, you know, the horrifying experience that they had. But just the fact that they had, and some people had moments to make calls to see if they went through to say goodbye to their loved ones. And this happened, you know, in the World Trade Centers and at the Pentagon as well. It's 5:21. We'll take a break. We're coming back in a moment. You know, Sue was gone for a few days out in Connecticut. And, you know, as much and as closely as you and I followed the Lindsey Clancy case, I know what happens when you're on vacation. You kind of dip out. You're not paying attention. So you've kind of missed the aftermath of this, right?
I have, yes.
So the mistrial was declared on Friday after, you know, a couple of days of long, long deliberations where the judge had to send them back into the jury room. So I came on here on Tuesday afternoon, Sue, and I would have said the same thing if you were here. I told Fred, I'm really, really surprised that over the course of the weekend, no jury members emerged to give their opinions on what happened. Well, that changed on Tuesday. Actually, I think it was...
Because of the holiday weekend,
well,
maybe?
Well, I don't, you know, maybe, but there was a TV station in Boston that finally sat down with three of the jurors, and all of these were white women who had pretty much declared that they were all in for not guilty by reason of insanity, but they focused on that one standout juror, right? And this guy, they claimed, was not cooperating, that he would not listen to the judge's instructions. They got very frustrated. Now, there was another juror, and I came, some of these people, they've shown their faces. There was one female juror we'll call her juror number four because I'm about to play juror number five. We're only calling them that based on how they've come out publicly. All right.
Okay.
So you had the first three jurors, and then juror number four is a woman. She comes out anonymously, so you don't see her face. And she says, well, wait a second here. The standout, you know, the holdout, he wasn't the only one with conflicting opinions. So then you're kind of given a different, you know, view of what might have been happening in that jury room. Now you have juror number five who's come up, a guy by the name of Nick Dargy, who says this is his story.
Take me inside the deliberation room.
There was several times I would ask him to show us like evidence or, you know, describe a witness testimony that helped to prove what he was saying, and he couldn't. There wasn't a single piece of evidence or witness testimony that he used to prove why he was thinking the way he was, which is why we ultimately sent in that note. Otherwise, like, there's nothing wrong with somebody having a completely opposite opinion. Like, that's, you know, that would be a hung jury. That, like, that is our justice system.
You know, several people have made that point that he just sort of emphasized there. There's nothing wrong with someone in the jury.
Thank
it's not
goodness.
Like, I don't think any of these jurors had an issue with him having a different opinion. They were frustrated, in their words, that he was unwilling
to follow
some of the simple rules. And then one juror said he even admitted that he had reasonable doubt, but he didn't agree with the definition of reasonable doubt.
Well,
so that's why he held out. So Kevin Rennington, look, the other thing that happened, and this has not really been addressed properly, although I'll have his comment. He goes out in the aftermath of this, and he feels so emboldened because he knows it's 11-1, right? He knows it's in his favor, 11-1. They get that the math works in his favor. So he praises the jury. He thanks them for their service, but he rips, and he actually calls out the holdout juror and says, I hope he can sleep at night. For many people who are legal experts, Jonathan Turley amongst them, they thought that that was really outrageous. I mean, I've covered trials. I've never heard a prosecutor or a defense attorney single out one juror and put sort of a target on their back.
You said he stole 7 weeks of the life of these other jurors. Jeez. And you said, I hope that guy can sleep well at night. Do you regret at all calling that juror out?
Well, first of all, and I don't think I called him out, so to speak. He was revealed in his gender at the time of the SJC argument. I was angry because of his refusal to follow the law.
We don't know what this one juror actually means or have said.
Probably a matter of time before he's getting interviewed somewhere and you can find out.
So far, nothing.
That's how the system is supposed to work.
When a juror has reasonable doubt and refuses to apply it in accordance with the judge's instructions, no, that's not how the system is supposed to work.
When a juror feels...
And if you were in that chair that Lindsey Clancy was and I was representing you, you would be very upset about that juror.
Haven't you been on the opposite side of these decisions?
Of course. And Hasn't there been a juror that applauded the jurors? I applaud the jurors that hang tight for a defendant. Absolutely. 12 angry men. Unfortunately, that's not what the facts are.
Great movie, by the way. If you've never seen it, the remake wasn't that great. But, you know, he still harbors a lot of anger toward that one juror. What I find interesting is, again, there was the other female juror that said, wait a second, that's not the whole narrative. I hope this guy comes out. Now,
I don't know if he will.
He could be angling for money. You just don't know what's at play here. But some, you know, one by one, people have been kind of emerging telling their stories. Mm. If I were any of these people, I wouldn't put my face on camera.
I wouldn't either,
no
Mark.
Way.
So, if he doesn't show up ever, I'm
Can't
not
Can't blame
surprised.
Him for that, right. I have an audio cut of the day before the hour is up. I have a very important, so you're like this, I have a very important public service announcement for the audience. You know I care about people.
Oh, boy.
I'm a giver, and I do want to pass along some words that are very important, so we'll do that during audio cut of the day. Don't forget, it's a Reardon Roundtable tomorrow at 3, former state senators John Lamping and Jeff Smith on the panel. Gosh, I wonder if we'll talk about the kerfuffle with the Missouri congressional map.
Oh, my gosh. I hope somebody can make sense of it.
Nobody can do that. That's actually impossible right now. I have so much to talk about with my friend John Ziegler, the co-host of the podcast, The Death of Journalism. Of course, he also has the podcast with the benefit of hindsight that has focused on the Jerry Sandusky case. John, I told Fred, I said, we literally have the world's foremost authority on Jerry Sandusky on speed dial. That's you. So we've been talking about this stuff, about your podcast for years, but now Jerry Sandusky was actually in the news last week.
Yeah, and typical of this incredibly odd story, I'm the reason why the hearing that got so much publicity did not actually transpire, which sounds incredibly counterintuitive, but I basically jumped on a hand grenade when I realized that this was going to be a complete and total disaster, because the so-called recantation witness, so-called victim number 10, a guy by the name of Ryan Rittmeyer, is someone that I had interviewed for over 2 hours last year. And I was very, very much convinced before I spoke to him, and even more so afterwards, that he was never abused by Jerry Sandusky. But I also knew he would be an absolutely terrible witness under these circumstances for a whole host of reasons. So I'm the reason, because I both publicly and privately vehemently lobbied against it, that the hearing that got so much publicity did not actually transpire. But one thing that did happen, which was positive, which I've been lobbying for about 10 years, is that Jerry Sandusky is finally getting out of Pennsylvania state court and going to federal court for his appeal, where he at least has a semblance of a chance of getting a fair hearing for the first time in 15 years.
So when that guy refused to testify or would not do whatever the next step would be, is that ever going to happen, or that's just off the table now?
To be clear, that's not what happened. It wasn't like he reneged on his recantation. He has signed an affidavit saying that his trial testimony was not accurate and all sorts of very interesting, important things. What happened was I was able to convince the people that mattered, the lawyers, the advisors, and Jerry Sandusky, that this was not a risk worth taking, mm-hmm. because this guy was not trustworthy. Imagine this, Mark, a guy who lied in 2012 to get $5.5 million in Penn State, and who has been in prison for robbery in the past and has a massive amount of drug use and gambling in his history, yeah. is not a reliable person.
Well, you told me that last week. Yeah, I mean, you predicted this was going to, you know, not be a good thing last week. So where
I told you this wasn't going to happen last week.
I know, you did. You told everybody. So, but does this, because it's shifted to federal court, it gives you a little bit more hope that some of the facts might come out in this case? That's what I'm hearing?
Well, in theory, I'm not actually that optimistic about this for a couple of reasons. Number one, Jerry Sandusky is 82 years old. And he's already starting to lose his marbles. I mean, I wrote a statement for him to read, mm-hmm. So we could break this news. And that was incredible. It was a miracle. We got it done, given, you know, his mental state and where he is in prison and all he's endured, in my belief, for the last 15 years. But this is going to be a very long process. It's a completely different kind of ball game in federal court. But what it does, Mark, is it at least has the chance of providing a fair hearing. Because the number one thing people don't understand about this case, and why people who don't know this case think I'm nuts until they find out the reality of this,
yeah.
is they don't understand the perverse self-interest and incentive structures. This case is all about the perverse self-interest and incentive structures. And when you have an entire apparatus of an entire state, the politics, the media, the judges who are elected, the population that's convinced Jerry Sandusky is the worst man in the history of the world, deeply, deeply invested in a dark fairy tale, there's no chance to get justice. It's not possible. This was the Salem witch trials of the 21st century. That's not an exaggeration.
Look,
even if Jerry was guilty, which he's not, he's clearly innocent. His trial was such an abomination from a due process perspective. I believe an objective federal judge would look at this and go, what the hell was this?
It's such
and
a mess.
And immediately order yeah. a new trial.
It's such a mess. And look, I've known John for the audience, you should know, since about 2009 is when the documentary on Sarah Palin came out. You came here. We packed a theater. We became friends. I got yep. to see you in L.A. every once in a while. When you started down this path, I mean, I never reached out and said, John, what the hell are you thinking? I thought you were crazy. I didn't think there was anything to it. Until I listened to the damn podcast, until you brought the receipts and the goods, and there's no way to deny the facts that you bring to this case. Now, I didn't listen to every minute of the podcast, John, but I listened to a lot of it, and it's just undeniable. And that's why, if people are, you know, they're skeptical, they should be maybe listen to with the benefit of hindsight, because it's going to change your mind.
Mark, let me just say one thing about that, because I can't stand conspiracy theorists, and because I'm an ardent anti-conspiracy theorist, and I really can't stand when people can poke holes in the conventional wisdom, like we're about to commemorate 9/11, right? The 9/11 conspiracy nut jobs, they always raise questions that are,
yeah,
they have no alternative scenario. They have no alternative scenario whatsoever. I have an incredibly detailed, documented, verified,
yes,
alternative scenario that is far, far more logical and far more based in common sense and evidence than the dark fairy tale that we were given. And it's not close. Everyone that listens to the With the Benefit of Hindsight podcast comes away going, saying the same thing. Oh, my God, this isn't close. This was a witch hunt. This was a perfect storm. This was a moral panic that needs to be fixed. But unfortunately, we don't live in a world where that can happen in this day and age, Mark. We just don't. Our media is not prepared for it. Our judicial system, our politics, it's all too broken.
All right. So there's an interesting story today, though. Was it a bunch of gymnasts that came out at the University of Michigan, male gymnasts that are alleging
former hockey players. Hockey players.
Right.
I'm so glad you're mentioning this. I'm so glad. This is amazing. Do you want me to talk about
Yes, I do, because I think that what you're going to kind of connect the dots on here is, again, there's financial incentive, right?
Penn State and Sandusky started a contagion within specifically the Big Ten Conference, where eventually people, former athletes, figured out, oh my gosh, we got a massive loophole here. We can claim ancient allegations of sexual abuse with no evidence, no logic, especially if our perpetrator is dead. And these academic institutions that are afraid of their own tail, run by liberals who want to use other people's money to virtue signal, are going to cave immediately and give us free money. And guess what happened? Once it occurred, once or twice,
the floodgates were open.
The floodgates are open. Other athletes figure this out. But this one, Mark, has to be the most ridiculous of all of them. We're supposed to believe that hockey players, anyone knows about the culture of hockey.
They kick your ass.
That hockey players from 25 to 40 years ago were enduring what they're calling sexualized hazing, whatever the hell that is, and apparently had no idea that this had occurred for well over a generation.
A quarter of a century, yeah. No, it's...
Never said a word about it. And then all of a sudden, 16, and this number is important, 16 former Michigan hockey players make a federal complaint, because it's outside of the statute of limitations, so mm-hmm. They have to make up some civil rights claim. But 16 players out of the years that are involved here, that's like less than one player a year that decides to sign off on this. If this really was happening, you would see an avalanche. But instead, you get a trickle, because only a few of these guys are willing to sell their souls to a lawyer who sees blood in the water, because Michigan has had to settle a whole bunch of other claims, and it's other people's money. I cannot emphasize that enough. Liberal institutions spending other people's money to make themselves look good and to virtue signal. How the media keeps falling for this is absolutely mind-blowing. But the media is actually part of this boondoggle, because they put pressure on the academic institutions, and their instincts are to immediately cave. Michigan, to their somewhat credit, actually put out a statement that was, for a liberal academic institution, not horrendous. It basically was written by somebody with maybe one tiny semi-functional testicle instead of, you know, two working ones. But they have denied the allegations in the most timid way possible, because they know it's ridiculous.
Yeah. John Ziegler, boy, I had so much more I wanted to talk to you about, including your daughter singing this song I saw online today for South Park. Because, and by the way, John, I don't know if you know this, you were the only live guest that we had a year ago on this date, because it was the Charlie Kirk assassination, and you told the story of Grace getting an autographed hat from Charlie Kirk. That was the only live guest we had, because we were kind of cutting in and out with Fox coverage. But what she was reacting to the fact that South Park had changed the name of the show to South America, right?
She instantaneously asked me to record her singing her obituary to her favorite cartoon song, South Park. And she sang in the voice of Cartman, the star of South Park.
That is awesome. By the way, you know, we have some commonality here, because I have an 11-year-old who's in sixth grade, and I think Grace is in eighth grade. And every time I see a picture of her, it's the same reaction I have with my daughter. She looks like she's a lot older than she should be. So God bless you, John. You're in some of the same challenges that I have. But I hope all is well, and we'll talk soon. I appreciate coming on tonight. Well, first of all, Sue, thank you so much for asking. Jackson Smith and Jigba scored a lot of points for me last night on my fantasy team, so I got a really good start off here this week on my team. Uh-huh. And I knew you were worried about that, especially since you were gone. Uh-huh. But, you know, I also occasionally, we do a lot of things here on this show. A lot of it is entertainment-based, but some of it, you know, I like to give to the community and offer public service and public service announcements because I think that's an important part of being a broadcaster. And you know me. I'm generous.
You're a giver.
I care about people. Yes. I want people to get along and everyone to be on the same page. And you also know I love Diet Coke, right? So well, this is a very more important than anything else is that, and that's why I pass along and I share this very important PSA.
So many people ask me why I drink so much Diet Coke. And the truth is, I have a condition. My body doesn't naturally produce Diet Coke. And so every day I have to supplement.
Yep.
It's a lifelong diagnosis, but thankfully it's manageable as long as I stay consistent with treatment.
Yes.
If you or a loved one is living with Diet Coke deficiency, please know you're not alone.
Yeah. I do not have Diet Coke deficiency, but you know, you just don't know, and that's why you have to be careful, and that's why I wanted to share that for the audience as a public service announcement.
Playback ready.
Now, the audio cut of the day.
Well, not to bring the mood down, but I did mention with John that this was the one-year anniversary of the Charlie Kirk assassination. It was just horrific. I was in my office. Ethan got very emotional. He was a big fan of Turning Point. And younger people of faith in particular really were struck by Charlie, and then they were deeply, deeply affected by his death. And it wasn't only his death. It was the violent nature of it. I mean, we all saw it happen.
Yes.
And unfortunately, I'm not one of those people that can say, I have to look away and I don't want to see it. But here is a little bit of a montage of Charlie Kirk and what made him so special to so many millions of Americans.
There I was, a young high school graduate with no money, no connections, and no idea what I was doing. I said, hey, I think we could do a better job of reaching young people.
Yeah.
I go around universities and have challenging conversations, and because that's what is so important to our country, is to find our disagreements respectfully.
You don't have to accept being worse off than your parents. You don't have to feel aimless and unhappy. You don't have to support leaders who lied to you and took advantage of you for your vote. America's future is a series of choices.
You need to enjoy every day, then.
Therefore, every day.
Because the reward is actually the process. We've been through so much together.
That's right. You galvanize as a team.
Yes, exactly. And the memories that are created and the connectivity, right? That's what life is really about. At its core, it's about relationships.
I want to be remembered for courage for my faith. That would be the most important thing. The most important thing is my faith in my life.
A lot of impact Charlie Kirk had. My guess is that you'll hear about him tonight in Dallas at the second night of the GOP midterm convention. We'll be back. We'll talk about it tomorrow at 3 with the Reardon Roundtable. Have a great night.
Get more at 971talk.com.